Paul, let me ask you something. Do you like your family?
It's a really complicated question, Steve. I didn't realize this is where we're going to be going right now.
No, I mean, do you like seeing pictures of your family?
Yeah, sure. Pictures of my family are nice. Yes, sir.
Okay, I've got a great recommendation for you. It is the Aura frame. You've probably seen some of these before. You go to your friend's house and they have a frame on the cabinet or in the living room or whatever, and it has digital photos.
Sure. Yes.
Well, I got this thing and I set it up, super easy to set up. I basically dumped a bunch of photos from my phone right onto it. Very easy to do. Took me just minutes.
All this sounds scary to me.
No, it's incredibly easy.
It's not hard. Okay.
And basically you can put like, seems like an almost infinite amount of photos on this thing. And then you can set the parameters and it can rotate your family through like every 30 seconds.
Amazing.
And it's great because I've got pictures of my son, my family.
Cool.
My dad passed away a few years ago. I get to see him popping up every now and then. The good ghosts of your personal history coming through on this thing.
Nice. That's nice.
They have a great deal for Mother's Day, so listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code ChinwagPod at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, 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 here we are with another Chin Wag, Steve. Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti, and I'm joined by my co-host and cohort in weirdness, the distinguished philosopher and author, Stephen Asma.
Hello, hello, yes, and we have a really great episode for you all today.
We had so much to talk about on Chin Wag, we didn't have a chance to get to everything, so today we bring you more of that chat.
Yeah, before we get into it, though, thank you to all our loyal listeners for writing in. We love hearing from you, so please keep it up. And don't forget, you can also follow us on Spotify. And thanks to Spotify for showing us so much love and support. And don't be stingy. Tell your friends about us. Text them a link to this very podcast right now. They'll thank you for it.
Okay. Okay. Enough of that.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You've written on zombies. The history is fascinating. I know it's a huge history, but like, could you give listeners a little potted history of the zombie that we could then dig in on?
Yeah, the zombie has not been a huge part of popular culture for as long as people might imagine. It really came to mass awareness in 1929. Before that, it was something that you might read a mention of it in like a travelogue to the Caribbean or something like that. But in 1929, a writer named William Seabrook puts out a book called The Magic Island. And Seabrook was an interesting guy. He had traveled the world sort of inserting himself into local cultures. And he was obsessed with the occult. And he was even friends with Aleister Crowley. He was an odd guy. And he spent a year in Haiti. And he wrote this book about it. And chapter 7 of the book is entirely about zombies. And so he was the first guy to bring this to the mass attention of the American public. The book sold very well. Within a couple of years of that book coming out, there was a zombie play on Broadway, which failed after 2 weeks. But
amazing.
That did not fail is the 1932 film White Zombie, starring Bela Lugosi, which was a huge hit. It was made on very little money. It was produced independently outside of Universal or any of the other big studios, and it made a fortune. And it
was he famous? Just real quick aside, was
Lugosi
famous?
Did he done Dracula already? Was he already?
He had already made Dracula, and it was he was kind of in some weird contractual loophole with Universal, and so he was able to step out and go do this film, which probably took him, I think, something like 5 days to shoot or something. Sure. And that made zombies huge. After White Zombie hits in 32, we get a ton of these voodoo zombie films.
Yeah.
Going throughout the 30s and 40s. And then in the 50s, we get the beginning of the sci-fi zombie, which are brought about by atomic radiation, that kind of thing. And then, of course, it isn't until 1968 that Romero comes along and gives us the zombie that is out to consume human flesh, which was not part of any zombie folklore before 68.
Oh, so he completely invented that idea. I didn't realize that it was.
Yeah, I thought he was drawing on the tradition, but he invented that. That's crazy.
He did. And in fact, if you watch Night of the Living Dead, they're never called zombies in the movie. He resisted using that word. Even in Dawn of the Dead, which is 10 years later, that word only pops up once. And he said that he thought of them as ghouls because he had grown up with the tradition of these Caribbean voodoo zombies. And he didn't think of them as the same thing. Yeah.
And voodoo, they're used as kind of, it's people who are resurrected, if I get this right, to kind of be used as sort of carry out tasks.
Like a tool.
Yeah, sort of. It's like a golem or something a little bit, isn't it? I mean, it's like sort of resurrected body that will then do your bidding a little bit, right?
I actually think it's kind of a metaphor for the horrors of slavery because it was in the Caribbean where you had black laborers and the idea was that even after you died, a voodoo bokur, which was the name for the sort of what we would call a witch doctor, could resurrect the corpse and make it continue to work out in the field.
Yeah,
and, it's interesting that in the traditional folklore, there are a few spins on it that you don't see used much in the movies. For example, they have to eat, but they can only eat very simple food like gruel. And if you ever give a zombie salt or meat, it will immediately regain consciousness and go rebury itself.
Really?
Oh, weird.
Wow.
Fascinating.
That's crazy.
I Walked with a Zombie is a pretty good movie.
That's a creepy film.
Yeah,
I've seen
it. Very creepy movie. Yeah.
But it's got racial, like, undertones.
How could
it
not? I mean, all of it's got unbelievable
anxieties about race.
Yeah, all of the anxieties about race and that stuff is pretty intense.
Yeah.
The Serpent and the Rainbow, which is a good, decent movie, but that book, it was a book. And what was the story with that? The guy, he was like an ethnobotanist who looked into the whole reality of the zombie thing, right?
Yeah, Wade Davis, he was a Harvard-trained ethnobotanist. And he is the one who kind of first suggested that zombies were actually people who hadn't died, but who were in a drugged state that rendered them with that kind of no intelligence, no willpower thing. And he has been largely debunked.
Has he?
But there is still a lot of discussion over how much of what he said could actually be accurate. They go back and forth on that a lot.
Interesting.
I know Zora Neale Hurston also swore that she had seen a real zombie. And I was thinking, yeah, could there just be like, I know this is going to sound, I mean, could there just be like terrible head injury cases or illnesses that leave somebody, you know, compromised?
Catatonic or something, or sort of.
And then people just misunderstand what's happening, you know, is that possible? And what do you think it is? Or is it just lore and legend?
I suspect you're absolutely right. The Zora Neale Hurston story is really interesting and has a little bit of a tragic overtone to it. And she even included a photo of the person she was told was a zombie. It's in her book, Tell My Horse. It's a really good book. I recommend it highly. And I suspect you're right that there are probably people who were injured or in some way that they didn't get proper care. It's a very hot region. Maybe they've got severe heat stroke on top of whatever else is going on. And perhaps it puts them in some kind of suggestible state because the idea of being controlled was always part of it.
Do we think Frankenstein is like the first zombie story? I always wonder, like, why it's not called a zombie story, because it is, isn't it, in a lot of ways?
I argue it's not.
Okay.
And I actually do see, I think the Romero zombie and the voodoo zombie are the same creature. And I think the things they have to have is it is a physical body. It's not a ghost. It is resurrected from the grave, but it has no willpower or real intelligence, which it lets Frankenstein out.
So Frankenstein, because he has will.
Smart.
And he has,
the creature's smart.
He is smart, which people, I think, forget that he speaks and he's smart. And I guess he's...
He like learns language like outside the window or something.
He talks. And I mean, I guess is he, I can't remember in the book. I haven't read the book in so long. Is he cobbled together from bodies or is he just one
body
single
parts.
Body? Yeah, I could never remember. And vampires have no relation to them either, do they? I mean, because it's like... Although the early vampire lore, when you look back, I mean, the 19th century Bram Stoker vampire thing, no. But when I read about sort of earlier vampire lore, that sounds like the same thing, kind of, or similar. I mean, it's not like, I guess your worry is the person's going to come back to life. Is that right? I'm not sure about some of the earlier stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right. The earlier stuff is kind of what I call zombie adjacent. It's
zombie adjacent. That's our whole show.
Yeah, it really is.
If you look at like the early Eastern European folklore on zombies, they do tend to be described as things that had very little intelligence. They would emerge from the grave and just be ravenous for blood, and they would gorge themselves and go right back to the grave. They were not glamorous or sexy or any of that kind of thing.
No, they were kind of, mindless too.
There's a story that I'm going to get all the details wrong on this, but there was like people were dying even as late as like the late 19th century. So we're talking about the late 1800s where people were dying of consumption. And there was a fear that this girl, this was in Rhode Island. She's like the vampire Rhode Island. They thought she was coming out of the grave and feeding on family members when in fact they were just suffering from this illness.
Oh.
They went in and they cut her head off and then they made some kind of a tincture from her bone and fed it to the brother so that he would then be cured and no longer attacked by the vampire. And well, he died like a few months later. The whole thing was just debacle. But
when,
that was, late 1800s.
Late 1800s.
This is like the 1890s, I think.
Wow. I know about the disease. I think it's porphyria that a lot of people have suggested vampirism might stem from. But I hadn't heard that case. That's very interesting.
What's porphyria?
It's a real disease that apparently it renders you, you have a hard time with extreme light. You tend to seek the darkness. You, I think, have anemia. It's this thing that you can see how it could be mistaken for vampirism.
One thing that I like to think about monsters, I think about that they're a threat, and then there's also sort of a security response to that threat. And in the zombie case, I've just wondered if we could talk a little bit about, like, what's the real threat that we're culturally rehearsing?
What are we afraid of?
Is it the contagion thing? Is it the grid going down? You know, like, and then you see, like, the responses could be like, well, maybe the military is going to fuck it up and it's going to be lay people are going to, respond.
Or medicine's going to fuck it up. The medical establishment's going to blow it or something. Yeah.
What's the popularity of zombies about now, you think?
My theory is that it represents our fear of conformity. That after death, we will be stripped of our individuality and just be made to be these lumbering things that are bent on consumption. And I think it's no surprise that zombies really rose in popularity in the 70s when there were all kinds of counterculture movements. People were being encouraged more and more to express and explore their individuality. Along comes this thing where you are just reduced to a member of a horde. I think the horde is very important within the zombie mythology. Now on the other hand, you have the heroic hunter or survivalist who is the person who is standing alone against this shambling, mindless horde.
That makes sense.
They're kind of just pure death, too. They're just sort of death manifest and walking around is the thing to me that makes them particularly sort of creepy and menacing.
And they're grotesque and they're just rotting. And that does sort of symbolize, it's what's going to happen to everybody.
Definitely.
So there is, it's like the fundamental fear that we have.
I'm always curious about somebody like George Romero. I always, I was saying this to you, Steve, about like, is he a guy? Was it the thing that he found? And then he just figured, I have to just keep following this out to its logical conclusion because this is my thing? Or was it like, I'm really into this
stuck?
And I need, yeah. Well, I mean, in other words, was he stuck with it? Or was it something that he was like genuinely like, I've been fascinated with this. This is something I have to keep investigating. Or was he a little stuck with it?
He was stuck with it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I wonder about those guys often.
Yeah.
Like so much with the sort of horror meister guys. And I was saying to Steve, I know some of these guys. And I often wonder, I've never just said to them, like, are you stuck with this? You know, mm-hmm. But tell me more about it because...
There's a great book that's coming out in a couple of months called Raising the Dead, which is by a friend of mine, Adam Hart, that he had access to Romero's archives. And he found out a lot of things about Romero that no one else has ever unveiled before, including the fact that he made a complete feature film before Night of the Living Dead, which he didn't finish, but it's not horror. And he was writing a lot of screenplays before and after Night of the Living Dead, not horror. He and his financial partners fixed on horror as a way to make a movie that would make money.
Yeah.
And I think they were as shocked as anyone when Night of the Living Dead became this kind of cultural touchstone. And he tried to kind of, I think, avoid going back to it. If you look at the movies he made after Night of the Living Dead, a couple are horror, a couple are not. And it takes him 10 years, though, to finally go back to Dawn of the Dead. And then that becomes a big hit, big enough that he can make whatever he wants. And his next film is a movie called Knight Riders, which has not a whiff of horror.
That's right. That's right.
It's a great movie.
It's great.
But it didn't make money. And
what's that about?
That,
what's Knight Riders about?
It's great.
It's about a troop of people who travel around. It's contemporary. They are a motorcycle gang, but they are a motorcycle gang that engages in jousting and lives by the rules of knights.
Yeah.
And they have
it's a kind of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Yeah. Ed Harris is sort of the central guy who's kind of the King Arthur guy.
Ed Harris is great. It's ultimately tragic because they end up realizing that this counterculture movement of theirs is destined to fail. And it's a beautiful movie, but it didn't make money. After that, Romero was really stuck forever with the horror stuff, and he wasn't always happy about that.
It's kind of like a Renaissance fair thing, a little bit, those guys on the motorcycles. It's like kind of motorcycle gang Renaissance fair
thing.
And that
didn't make money? I don't understand.
It's a great movie. It really is. I know, but it really is a great movie.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's worth watching. It really is great, because I just wonder about guys like that. And Steve, you were talking about some book that he wrote that you were aware of.
I've recently read this book by a writer in which the story is about a kid who gets trapped inside a whale, and it's an amazing book, and it's contemporary. But then apparently when looking at his back catalog, he was somehow paired with Romero at the very end of Romero's life to either finish a book or take it over. And I think it's called Rotters. And anyway, my brother was saying it was really good, and that got us thinking about Romero's legacy and how he saw himself.
That writer is Daniel Krauss. The book that he finished for Romero was The Living Dead. And
thank you.
As a shameless plug, he does the afterword to my book, The Art of the Zombie Movie.
Oh, great. Okay, it all comes together in the Chinwag.
There we go. Totally. Well, this was amazing.
Thank you for joining us.
And the books are great. The zombie book is beautiful. It's really gorgeous. Beautiful stuff.
Yeah, thanks. It was a real bucket list item for me because I always wanted to do a big coffee table art book. And
it's huge. It's huge. Really giant. Yeah.
And it's beautiful. I mean, the reprints.
And well-researched.
And thank you, Paul and Stephen. This was great.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Chinwag is a production of Treefort Media and Touchy Feely Films, hosted and executive produced by Paul Giamatti and Stephen Asma. Executive producers for Treefort are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman. Dan Carey is executive producer for Touchy Feely. Our series producer is Rachel Whitley Bernstein. Original theme music by Luke Topp, with additional music by Via Mardot. Oscar Guido is our executive in charge of production.
Tom Monahan is head of audio for Treefort. Audio production supervision by Matt Dyson. Editing and mixing by Jeff Neal. Animation created by Alex Sokol. Research assistance by Aiden Brooks. Lastly, for more information, go to chinwagpod.fm and find us on Instagram or TikTok at chinwagpod or on Twitter at chinwag_pod.
Hey, listener, it's Zach Harper, Amin El-Hassan, and Anthony Mays of Cinephobe. You may be asking yourself, what is Cinephobe? Amin, would you like to fill in the people?
Cinephobe is the podcast where Zach and I watch movies that are poorly rated on Rotten Tomatoes and try to ascertain.
Ascertain?
Yes.
Okay.
Ascertain. Whether or not they're accurately poorly rated, or maybe they didn't get a fair shake. Cinephobe, produced by this guy, Anthony Mays.
Hey, that's me. I produced this show. I also watch the movies, even though that wasn't included in the description, and I also ascertain. This month is...
Whoa!
Oh, Maze, why do you say that? Supercharge it. So that this promo can remain evergreen.
I feel like explaining a little bit more.
In 60 seconds?
I don't know. Maybe I don't bring attention to it. Assuring people like, look, if you listen, you're going to get it. Just give it time.
That's a good promo. Just listen to it.
Give it time.
You'll figure it out.
Is this the promo right now?
Isn't it?
Okay, I think we got it.
Cinephobe.
Wherever you get podcasts.